business as usual. Kenneth Moore looks at the period when America was still technically at peace, while Britain was at war. He reminds us that American music became involved in a battle of its own. And in Britain, civilian life went on with whatever normality it could cling to. He recalls that not everybody went to war, but that often enough it came to them. And so did entertainment.
History was even more untidy than usual in bequeathing us not one, but two dates for the start of the Second World War. While the British enjoyed a phony war, and then endured a very real one, the Americans waged a phony peace for 2 years. And in 1939 and 40, and for all but the last few weeks of 1941, therefore, business in America could hardly be anything but usual. President Roosevelt's divisive lend-lease would begin to send us guns and other hardware by 1940, but we'd been getting perhaps 70% of our popular music from America for years before that, and we will continue to do so for a long time to come. So it's relevant to open this episode by hearing what was happening in peacetime America when we were already at war. To do that, it's absolutely essential to make use of the flashback and resurrect Glenn Miller, who in last week's part of our story had gone missing without trace. As our war broke out, Miller, in the commercial sense, was just arriving.
Around 1940 was the height of the big band era. All the big bands were playing. Benny Goodman, Glenn Miller, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Tommy Dorsey, Jimmy Dorsey, Harry James, Les Brown, you name them. As a matter of fact, if you were in New York City at that time, you could go around to 20 different places of an evening and hear a big band and enjoy it, too. Either hear it in a ballroom or hear it in a hotel supper or dinner room, or else go to a theater or do any one of many, many places to hear, even amusement parks in the summertime. The big bands were just all over, and there were so many of them you could hear, and so many of them that were good.
The speaker is George Simon, author of two exhaustive books, one on Glenn Miller himself, another on the big bands in general. At the time, he was editor of the magazine Metronome, and the bands he mentioned were only a tiny fraction of those he heard and reviewed, so he knew who made up big bands' audiences.
Everybody. The kids would mostly go to the out-of-town places like the Glen Allen Casino and Frank Daly's Meadowbrook and the amusement parks. And, of course, they'd also go to the hotel rooms because the cover charge was very small and was 75 cents for a cover charge in those days, and drinks were not expensive. And kids could afford to go around and listen to the big bands and catch them in person, which is quite different, of course, what's happening today all over the world when these super rock groups rip off the kids at those fantastic prices for their services. And the older folks did also. They would go to some of the more expensive clubs where the bands might play. The kids, by the way, could also go and hear the bands in theaters. This was very big. You'd go into a theater in the morning and plunk down your 75 cents or whatever it was and stay all day if you wanted to. Nobody would kick you out. Of course, it meant you had to see the same feature picture three or four times. And sometimes it was funny. The kids, by the end of the day, would telegraph all the punchlines in the picture because they'd seen it several times before. But at least they saw their bands three or four, maybe even five times during the day. And they worship bands, you know, over here, just the way the sports fans over here worship baseball players and over in your country worship cricket players and soccer players. There's a tremendous hero worship among the kids and the performers in the big bands. Thank you.
Duke Ellington's orchestra with Take the A-Train. The big bands, when they weren't doing a resident engagement at some theatre, club or hotel, were of no fixed abode. They roosted in buses or trains and went through musicians the way children go through shoes. But as yet, the bands weren't feeling the draft, the American call-up. There were plenty of musicians, but in deference to an old American custom, some of the band leaders indulged in a certain amount of rustling. Cy Oliver, who himself had had an offer from Tommy Dorsey that he couldn't refuse, describes the process.
There was a great deal of that. In fact, I've known band leaders to pay much more than they could really afford to get a particular star, just to say that I had gotten him away from whoever he happened to be with. There was a great deal of that. In fact, after I began writing for Dorsey's band, I was approached by many of the major bands, and they offered ridiculous sums of money, but I knew what it was all about. I knew why they were doing it, and of course I was interested. In those days, there was a great deal of what they called battles of music. One of the things that all the bands looked forward to was playing what they call a battle of music, which simply meant there were two bands engaged to play the same dance, you know. And, of course, the idea was to outdo the other band. It was just a matter of professional pride and excellence.
Dorsey's band, with a number not only arranged by Cy Oliver, but also composed by him, and featuring him on vocal with a little help from Joe Stafford. The music you've heard so far today is the merest fraction of what was being produced in America as the 40s began. The Americans were still engaged in normal peacetime activities, and in their hundreds, the bands played on. The public called the tune, but on the whole, paid the pipers very well. The American jazz magazine Downbeat estimated that in 1940, Bob Crosby's band could expect to make about £60,000, of which £5,000 would go to Crosby, £3,400 to Ray Baduke, the drummer, and £3,000 to Bob Haggart, the bass player. Oh, by the way, Doris Day's share as the band's girl singer would be about £600. That £600 illustrates, as nothing else can, the humble status, well below the salt, that most band vocalists occupied in 1940. By the time their status had improved, something quietly revolutionary had also taken place on the Broadway musical stage. Pal Joey presented the musical theatre with its first real anti-hero, as well as one of its finest scores.
If they asked me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. I could write a preface on how we met so the world would never forget. And the simple secret of the plot is just to tell them that I love you a lot. And the world discovers as my book ends how to make two lovers of friends.
Nice. All lies, of course, for Joey Evans is a heel. He's the figure John O'Hara created in a series of short stories. But for every one person who knows the stories, there are 20 who know the tunes Richard Rodgers wrote for the stage adaptation's characters, and the words Lawrence Hart gave them to sing. Hart was possibly the most literate and lyrically daring of all the Broadway writers. He's certainly the most intriguing. Joshua Logan describes him.
Hart was a will-o'-the-wisp. He was very difficult. He was enchanting. He was cute. He was almost like a little gnome. He was terribly small. The cigars he smoked were bigger than his head, practically. And, he was like Toulouse-Lautrec in a way. About the same look, same coloring. And I think maybe only a tiny bit taller. But of course he spoke English and not French. He was quite a lot older than Dick Rogers, but he had a theory of how music should be and how lyrics particularly should be, and started a kind of style that nobody had ever really accomplished before. Very few people realize what a vast number of lyrics Larry Hart wrote. You know, he's the most underrated man that ever lived, as far as I'm concerned, in our theater. I mean, everybody knows him and laughs at the jokes he pulled and the lyrics. There's never been a better lyric than couldn't sleep and wouldn't sleep until I could sleep where I shouldn't sleep. Now, that's a fantastic lyric line. So let's do it.
I'm wild again, beguiled again, a simpering, whimpering child again. The trousers that cling to him.
bewitched, bothered, bewildered, and frequently burglarized. You would never have heard lines like, "The trousers that cling to him, and thank God I can be oversexed again," over the BBC in the early 1940s, since they were considered far too suggestive. At first, Pal Joey was something of an acquired taste. For those who did acquire it, it assumed great importance. Talking about it here are Betty Comden and Adolf Green, themselves lyric writers, librettists, and review artists.
Pal Joey was something we really looked up to as an ideal because it involved a certain Broadway gaiety and brilliance and music and lyrics that combined with a certain, we'd never seen before, a savagery and a look at the seamy side of life and a comment on false values and a certain kind of and maturity of characters. You know, it was a very honest, no punches pulled, unpleasant characterization. That was a sort of a thrilling example for us to look up to.
It sort of stuck out all by itself because even for years after, there were shows that were not anything like it. That was just there in 1941 and maybe didn't have an immediate influence. It was certainly lambasted by the New York Times when it was revived. It was glowingly received.
Right, same critic. Yeah.
It did shock a lot of people and offended a lot of people, but it was a hit.
Betty Comden and Adolf Green on the delayed effect but great significance of Pal Joey. By 1943, Lawrence Hart, an erratic, alcoholic genius, was dead. So he never lived to see the show achieve classic status and never saw it made into a film. Had he bothered to notice it, however, even in 1940, the year of the original Pal Joey, the man who was to one day play the lead in the film was unwittingly starting another musical revolution himself. Working for Tommy Dorsey at the time was bandleader, arranger Paul Weston. And he recalls his first reaction to this newcomer.
Tommy told me, he said, "I'm getting this new singer from Harry James' band." And I said, "Well, what's his name?" And he said, "Well, it's Frank Sinatra." And I said, "Well, first thing we ought to do, Tom, is change his name, because," I said, "he'll never really mean much with that name like that."
Well, I don't know. Frank Sinatra doesn't sound too bad a name to me. Joe Stafford also has memories of Sinatra's arrival in the Dorsey band. She was already there as lead singer of the Pied Piper's vocal group.
We knew we were going to have a new boy singer, but we did not know who he was or anything about him. And we never saw Frank, as a matter of fact, until the first show. We were on stage, and Tommy announced, you know, they had a new boy singer, and out came this rather frail-looking young man with a whole bunch of hair. Not terribly impressive to look at, but sang about no more than 8 bars of Stardust, as I remember, and a great hush fell over the theater, and you knew you were hearing something completely new and completely unique and completely wonderful.
Sometimes I wonder why I spend the lonely nights dreaming of a song. The melody haunts my reverie, and I am once again with you. When our love was new, and each kiss an inspiration.
Melody, the memory of love.
the immature but already distinctive voice of Frank Sinatra. At about the same period, 40 to 41, another singer was emerging, usually to be found just one leader behind Sinatra, Dick Haymes. He was Frank's replacement in the Harry James Band, and for a few months he was with Tommy Dorsey after Sinatra had left for his solo career.
Well, Sinatra and I were always neck and neck. It happened at approximately the same time. It was happening to me with Harry, and it was at the same time happening to Frank with Tommy. And then we sort of outstripped both of us. Frank and I outstripped the leaders. Frank became more important than Tommy, and I became more important than Harry. And Harry didn't particularly like it, obviously. But Tommy, being the showman that he was, I always have compared Tommy's philosophy to the philosophy of Jack Benny. You know, it's always been the Jack Benny show. Jack Benny's always been the star, but he's always surrounded himself with heavyweights. And he's let them do all the work, get all the laughs, and he's been the brunt of their jokes and so forth and so on. But he always emerges smelling like a rose, you know. And this is Tommy's philosophy. Tommy was a star maker. He, you know, he considered the people he had in his band. He had Frank, he had myself, he had the Pied Pipers, he had Buddy Rich, he had Ziggy Elman. He had Joe Bushkin on piano. Connie Haynes, Joe Stafford. The traveling arrangers with the band were Axel Stordahl, Cy Oliver, and Paul Weston. We're on the road with us, you know, and it was a showcase like you don't believe.
The events Dick Haymes has just related didn't happen overnight. So here he is again describing how a singer could benefit from the showcase process.
He was one of the musicians until the public started to take notice. And one of the big step-ups for a vocalist was not to be forced to sit on the bandstand and snap your fingers whilst you weren't working. When one became big enough to demand that one needn't stay on the stand, then it was like a step-up. It was a bit of prestige. You could sit at a table near the bandstand and so forth, and when you hear your intro music, you just sort of stroll up and do your number and so forth. Then you became sort of featured. In other words, you had to work your way up.
I'll get by as long as I have you. There may be rain and darkness too. I won't complain. I'll see it through. Poverty may come to me, it's true, but what care I say, I'll get by as long as I have you.
Well now, given the digestive tract made of asbestos, a distaste for sleeping, a fondness for living out of a suitcase, and the shrinking disposition of a politician or a prize fighter, life for the young American band leader, band musician, or singer was full of promise around 1940. Talent was an advantage too, but you also needed exposure. It came, at that time, through live radio as well as records. In fact, the two were linked. Dick Haymes explains how it worked if, for instance, a band did a short season at somewhere like the Blue Room of the Lincoln Hotel in New York.
Well, from there, one would get what used to be called remotes. Early in the evening, one network would come in, and we'd be on the air for half an hour. And then towards the end of an evening, another network would come in, and we'd be on the air for half an hour. Now, what you did with the remotes is you plugged the hell out of your records, and you did them over and over and over again, which sparked the sales of the records as well. So this is the way you got coverage.
Poverty may come to me, it's true, but what care I say, I'll get by as long as I.
Dick Haymes and the Harry James Band. And if you were the writer of that song, you did a good deal better than simply get by. As long as you were a member of ASCAP, the American Society of Authors, Composers, and Publishers, which collected money on your behalf from anyone who used your music in public for profit. If you didn't belong to ASCAP, which at the time was a very exclusive club, admitting only those he considered good enough, you got nothing. America's few large radio networks and its myriads of smaller stations operated for profit and were very heavy users of music, nearly all of it composed and published by ASCAP members. As 1940 and an existing agreement came to an end, ASCAP announced the sharply increased rates it proposed to charge in future. The broadcasters rebelled and from January the 1st, 1941, refused to play any ASCAP music over the air. Indeed, once they decided not to pay, they had no choice anyway. This left them little but traditional airs, some hillbilly songs, the odd blues, and Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair. It meant that bands and singers were faced with the prospect of going off the air, for almost everything they did was ASCAP stuff. They couldn't promote their new records, and authors and composers couldn't promote their new songs. You can imagine the effect on band leaders, Les Brown for one.
Yes, we played Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair every show during the ban. We were only allowed to do non-ASCAP tunes at the time. And we had to get a new book overnight if we wanted to play on the air. So we did, because we wanted the exposure.
Les Brown's band getting along with non-ASCAP music. Between January and October 1941, it was ASCAP versus the broadcasters, and virtually no ASCAP music was heard on the air. In anticipation of this almost Gilbertian situation, though Gilbert and Sullivan were still safely within copyright, the broadcasters had set up their own licensing and collection agency, Broadcast Music Incorporated.
Well, the plan was simply this, that there was a good deal of music that was not being paid for. There were a great many musicians in addition to the thousands who belonged to ASCAP. And the theory was that we could get those musicians to create a repertory which would be truly competitive with the ASCAP repertory.
But BMI started on a campaign to knock off ASCAP. And what they did was to sign anybody who could write a song. It made no difference, good, bad, or indifferent. They just signed everybody. And guaranteed these writers a certain number of performances per song and a certain amount of royalties, whether the songs earned it or not. And I remember seeing literature, which went around to all their various studios. One in particular said, people will never miss what they don't hear. But I think the quality of what we were given was way below what the people should have had.
Now, it so happened that BMI turned out to be the best possible thing for the American music business and also for ASCAP. The new ethnic writer, for instance, let us say, the hillbilly writer from Tennessee, the black blues writer from Arkansas or Texas or Alabama or Mississippi, could hardly get into ASCAP at all. They weren't interested. They were interested in the people who wrote Broadway shows and movie scores. And that was about it. BMI welcomed all the new unheard-of writers. So when the ASCAP strike started, we found ourselves using a whole lot of old standard material whose copyright had lapsed. And we existed on revivals of old Black Joe and My Old Kentucky Home and things like that.
ASCAP made the false assumption the public would complain. Nobody complained. Nobody. They didn't mind it. They didn't miss all the damn songs that they'd heard all those years. And ASCAP made a dreadful error in forcing the broadcasters into the performing rights business.
Now, I tell you, I used to look at the top 30 songs in the 1940s, and the top 30 songs were all ASCAP. All by the pop standard writers. Now and again a song from another field, but mainly they were the top 30 were by the pop standard writers. Then, with the formation of BMI, it became 28-2, 2 BMI, 25-5, 5 BMI, 2010, 15-15, and I thought this was all fair. But when it became 10-20 BMI, 525 BMI and 1 week 30 BMI songs. Well, I don't have to be any kind of legalistic mind to know that something is amiss here. Suddenly, not one pop standard writer can get on the list of popular songs. And what they have done, I think, is a great, great disservice to the art of music as I know it.
Well, there should never have been a BMI, because if it hadn't been for the arrogance of the people who were running ASCAP, the broadcasters would never have gone to the trouble to make BMI. As a matter of fact, the last offer that ASCAP turned down, if they had accepted it, today they would be something like $400 million richer.
So, fundamentally, it was about money. And how you viewed it depended, of course, on what it did to your wallet. But its effect on music was enormous. But it hurried into the open the influences which would eventually create rock and roll. In other words, it actually shortened our story. Meanwhile, of course, the British had been fighting a real battle. Here they come.
As they meet, he'll tell her how he's missed her, that after he's kissed her. And then they'll talk about that wedding morning. They'll plan a honeymoon, the army can't wait till June. There's a boy coming home on leave. He'll enjoy coming home on leave. They'll make it 10 days of heaven when he comes home on leave.
For civilians, wartime Britain was an eerie mixture of nightmare, abnormality, and a determination as far as possible to conduct business as usual. When September and October 1939 came and went, and there was still no sign of Goering and his demolition experts, relief at not finding themselves beneath a layer of rubble led the British, or some of them, to the inevitable reaction. By November, the West End, that starch-collared Xanadu, ruled over by the society band leaders, was back in almost full production. 50 bands were working every night in London, patriotically playing such things as Berlin or Bust, the Army, the Navy and the Air Force, Crash Bang, I Want to Go Home, which was not a premonition of the Blitz, but a song about the blackout, and They Can't Black Out the Moon. As 1940 opened, the start of the BBC Forces programmes and the beginning of rationing happened on successive days. The war may have been phony at that moment, but the shortages were becoming real enough, and in any case, the war wasn't to remain phony much longer.
Summer, you old Indian summer, you're the tear that comes after Junetime's laughter. You see so many dreams that don't come true. Dreams we fashioned when summer time was new. You are here to watch over some heart that is broken by a word that somebody left unspoken. You're the ghost of a romance in June, going astray, fading too soon. That's why I say farewell to you, Indian summer.
With a kind of prophetic irony, that song, 1939 words added to a 1919 Victor Herbert tune, reached the height of its popularity just as the Indian summer of the so-called phony war was drawing to a close. There's another irony in the fact that when, after the fall of France and the Battle of Britain, the war really came to the British civilian, the theatres did the reverse of what they'd done in 1939 and defiantly stayed open. The routine horror of the Blitz was somehow accommodated in the pattern of people's lives, even when they went to the theatre. Here's how things were managed at the London Palladium, as Florence Desmond remembers them.
Well, it was a curious thing, really. We got used to it. The show didn't stop. If there was an air raid, there used to be a red light flashed in front of the footlights, saying an alert has been sounded. And then very often you'd hear the bombs falling and the guns going, but the show still went on. And then when the all clear came, a green light flashed. But I don't remember ever seeing the audience get up and leave the theatre. It was the most amazing thing, that. I think they must have looked at us up on the stage and thought, well, if they can go through it, we can.
I'll never forget the people I met braving those angry skies. I remember well as the shadows fell, the lights of hope in their eyes. And though I'm far away, I still can hear them say, thumbs up. For when the dawn comes up, there'll be bluebirds over the white cliffs of Dover. Thank you. if you wait and see. There'll be love and laughter and peace ever after tomorrow when the world is free. The shepherd will tend his sheep, the valley will bloom again, and Jimmy will go to sleep in his own little room again. There'll be bluebirds over the white cliffs of Dover tomorrow, just you wait.
Vera Lynn, promoted by the war from a mere singer to being a symbol for forces and civilians alike. One of the things that helped to establish her was the long run of Apple Sauce at the London Palladium, in which she starred with Florence Desmond. The Palladium later on presented a show which was symbolic from start to finish.